Back to My Garden, episode 78.
Welcome to Back to My Garden. Discover your passion for gardening. Here's Dave Ledoux.
Are you a garden designer? Free report reveals how to double your garden design business in 12 months or less. Discover 10 ways to attract better clients while reducing costs. Escape the day-to-day grind of doing all the work yourself. You get instant access at www.backtomygarden.com/GD Top Secret. Are you concerned about toxic chemicals, GMOs, and frankenfood? Don't panic. Grow organic. Discover my new resource for organic gardening. Go to www.backtomygarden.com/myorganic. Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world when you listen to this. I'm Dave Ledoux, and welcome to another edition of Back to My Garden. Sensational episode for you today, folks. Our special guest, Ben, is a professional horticulturalist in Cambridge, England. He's a Weasley graduate, a Royal Horticultural Society blogger, a plant lover, and a photographer, and he's extremely fitness-focused individual. He's known as the Hort Doctor, and he's got the biceps to prove it. Please welcome from the UK, Mr. Ben Jones. Ben, I'm glad you're here.
Hey, well, thanks for inviting me on your show.
This is going to be one of the greatest episodes of all time because we get to talk about gardening and fitness, two things I'm very passionate about. I gave you a little intro. Ben, I want to hear your stories. Our listeners want to get to know you better. Take a minute or two and share with us a little bit about your background and how you got into gardening.
Great stuff. Well, thanks. Well, my horticultural interest didn't begin when I was the tiniest of children, but it really came about when I was around 14. Started getting more of an interest in the outdoors, and it really kicked off when I was in secondary school in my last year, maybe, or maybe 2 years to go, and we do a two-week work experience placement. Now, the previous year, my brother's friend had done his work experience at the Cambridge University Botanic Garden. And so for about a year, I thought, that seems really interesting. And I just was really focused on knowing when it was my turn to come round to doing that, that I wanted to choose that placement too. And I was successful in getting that. And really, you know, it sounds a bit twee, but the rest is history, really. I was hooked. I had the gardening bug. I wanted to be outside, wanted to find out more about the outdoors. I was really fortunate enough to have a front and back garden where I am. And in Cambridge, you know, it's quite dense housing in places. So some people don't have a garden at all. So it's been great to have and been very fortunate enough to have that. When I was a child, I wanted to be outside. And it was outside play, really. That's what the garden was used for. It's very practical for kicking all sorts of balls around. Later, I got my interest in gardening, and I got an interest in shape and colour and combinations of planting. But it wasn't really botanically interesting for me then. It wasn't the botany and the taxonomy wasn't the big deal. It was just kind of what looked nice and what would paint a pretty picture. And then I think when I was about sort of like 17, something like that, we had the first grow your own kind of movement started to come into the UK, and which was probably about 10 years ago now, looking back. And so we began to grow a lot more fruit and veg in our garden, and the cost efficiencies of things. And my dad, being an economics teacher, sort of grabbed at that and thought, yeah. Cost efficiency, way of life, you know, that would be really beneficial for us as a family. Since then, I've continued my formal studies, did an apprenticeship, worked in one of the Cambridge University colleges for about 6 years, and then continued to want to increase my knowledge and lose the passion for horticulture at Weasley until the present day.
Awesome. We've got a ton to talk about. You've given us a lot to build on. For those of you driving, Ben and I are going to kick back and relax and talk about gardening for half an hour. Don't try to take notes, especially if you're driving. Keep both hands on the wheel, and I'll take down all the resources and links that Ben shares. I'll have them up on the blog at Back to My Garden. Make sure you follow Ben on Twitter. He's at The Hort Doctor. That's THEHORTDOCTOR. And you can also find him on Facebook at facebook.com/The Hort Doctor. Where to start, Ben? Let's talk a little bit about Cambridge, because it's a very special city. You've got an ancient university there. I mean, Newton went to school there, didn't he? Isaac Newton?
You've got a lot of history going on in Cambridge. And I think we more recently we had an 800-year history of the university. So I'm thinking in America, are you up to about 100? So
yeah, Thompson Morgan is older than Canada.
Yeah, so there we are. You know, so we've got there's a lot of history in there. Lots of famous theories and stuff were out there. They're from people who came and they were Cambridge University graduates. So yeah, wherever you look, I think gardening does play an important role within the city. I mean, it's very architectural. You've got a lot of history in materials and shape and presence from buildings and how they're used. But I think, you know, the soft landscaping really, it complements it. It's not always noticed as well because it's appropriate and effective use of soft materials to enhance the historic structures.
Outstanding. Now, you've gone to school at Wesley. Not everybody's familiar with that. Can you talk a little bit about that institution?
Yeah, so RHS Wesley is where I just recently graduated from. It's the main out of four gardens that we have across the UK. Wesley's the largest and seems to be the most prestigious in terms of like collections from within the UK. It was a great place to study whatever your abilities within horticulture. I had already been training and learning for about 6 years before I embarked on the course there. It takes up, you know, your life, which is great because you get involved, deeply involved in it for a few years. Like I say, the diversity and the prestigious collections that they've got, you've got wide ranges that appeal to all. So if you're really interested in, you know, rock and alpine plants or things that can withstand much colder climates, they cater for things like that. If you're interested in the tropic and temperate climate plants, they've got those within the glass houses there. And then lots of the herbaceous and specimen trees and whatnot that survive in our outdoor climate in the UK are all on show to see.
Now, I'm not going to be cheeky, Ben, but being Canadian, I travel a lot and I'll bump into people that say, oh, I know somebody from Toronto. Do you know Bill from Toronto? And I go, no, I don't know him. He's, you know, 4 million people. But at Wesley, I have an acquaintance, a friend that works there. He's the deputy curator, Matthew Pottage.
Oh, yes.
You ever met him?
I have indeed, yes.
I'm always blown away by the inner circles are all connected in high-level gardening in England. What a small world.
Yeah, it was great. He offered to do a few of the walk and talks that we used to call it. So different members of staff have been there for different members of different lengths of time or have particular interests. So he's got a great interest in conifers. So when we have like a conifer walk around and look at the different conifers that are around at Wesley, he takes us on a little tour, gives us some notes and teams up with one of the botanists and we go around and have a bit of fun, talk about conifers for a bit.
I need your help because I have a lot of parents that listen to the show and of young teens. And right now, especially in North America, kids are going to university and spending a fortune. They're going into debt for ridiculous amounts of money to get a degree that really doesn't lead to a career path. And there's in North America, this bias against horticulture as a career path, whereas in England, it's celebrated and very viable. For the mothers out there and the parents out there of teenagers, tell them a little bit about what your experience has been like choosing horticulture as a way of life.
Yeah, I mean, it was something that didn't... Well, when I came to think about careers after I left college, which we're sixth form here, so it'll be like about 18 years of age, I was thinking, well, how do I turn what my interests were from subjects in school and an increasing interest in plants into a career? Because... You know, I was doing geography at school, and it was like, you know, field trips and field study and physical geography and all that sort of thing. And then that kind of led me into, you know, wanting to know a bit further on. But to answer your question, it's like you realize that you can't necessarily embark straight away, but it's about choosing from that study side of things. I mean, you know, obviously stay in school and is rule one, and then it's looking at trying to continue study by, when we have, we're starting to get some really good apprenticeship schemes going on in this country now. And it's about, it's trying to like take that illusion of, you know, working the land or having a practical skilled job rather than an indoor office-based job, you know, the physical use of your hands and your brain together and stop that being undermined. And it's really interesting for you to say that, you know, that you're thinking it's great in this country, because I to an extent I would agree, but I think there's also more that needs to be done here as well, you know, with decreasing this assumption of that it's for people that can't make the grades at school. So really trying to look into what sort of apprenticeships can be going on, or hands-on training. And these can be, you know, successions of, like, you know, one-year courses or six-month courses, whatever you can do. See if you can liaise with some local gardens, you know, or private gardens or parks or greenkeepers, depending on where your interests might lie, and see if you can, if you're able to volunteer, because you've got that catch-22 or vicious circle of, oh, I would like to get, I want to be able to get a job in this, but I haven't got the experience. But then, you know, I haven't got the experience because I can't get a job. And so, and if you're able to do the apprenticeship side of things as well, the way they work here, it's, you know, there's a lot less upfront fee. So it's actually more cost efficient, because you're, the hard graft isn't having to pay off debt at the end. It's just trying to retain all the information that you've sustained from doing a course. Does that help?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I know in your case, in 2015, you're going to have a change of scenery because of your career choice.
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, since leaving from Wisley, I've just been doing some freelance work, and it's great to do the independence and you know, have the independence and do tasks from start to finish. Completely plan and renovate gardens and redesign things. I'm going to need that responsibility because I'm off out to Sicily on a 6-month Mediterranean garden project in conjunction with a high class, high end cooking school. So they're going to need places to chill out in when their food's cooking, and they're going to need some produce in order to cook with. So that's going to be where I come in. And be part of a small team there who's going to be sort of like co-managing and running the development of that, or the continual development. They have they like to get people in on 6-month placements, and I'm fortunate enough to go out there and do that. So be different type of climate, different type of people, different way of life, different approaches. So it's going to be a great experience, hopefully.
It makes a lot of sense, right? If you're cooking at the highest level, you'd want the best possible produce.
Yes, and I think as my career's developed, and as you learn more and you meet more people, that there's sectors outside of horticulture that link into horticulture, and food is definitely one of those things. I think, you know, I know the French chef, like Raymond Blanc, he's mad on cooking, and he has like these family apple trees where he's got, you know, 50 plus varieties of apple growing on one tree, because he's just found out about grafting and how that works, and he's got some professionals in to help him do that. And then that's cost effective. It's you know, a space saver, but then he gets all the different apples that he wants for all the different pies and desserts and savory things that he'll do. So, I mean, that's just one example of where, you know, horticulture isn't, reduced in terms of like, you know, thinking out there. It's as wide as you want to make it, really. And things, the more you think about other sectors, the more horticulture does actually link in with them. So it's really important for everyone to learn something if they can.
You know, one of my favorite cities in the world, Ben, is London, England. And the last several times I've been there, my friends kind of feed me traditional London food, which half the time you're going for Indian anyhow. So I'm appalled at the lack of vegetables and fruit in the average Londoner's diet. Like, it's a wonder they're not getting scurvy, because between the traditional English breakfast and the way, like, the shops, and I guess it's such a dense urban city, but can you talk a little bit about this, because you're so into fitness, the importance that gardening can play in an athlete or fitness enthusiast's lifestyle?
Yeah, well, I think just the linking with food, I think, and then nutrition to start with, I think it's, it is an issue. It's whether you know, there's lots of different diet choices and regimes out there, and I'd say lots of them are quite false proclaimed, really, and I would say don't really listen to many of them. I'd say listen to your body, and everything should be moderation. Moderation is the word I would use, because everyone's different. People are different heights and different weights initially, and whether you want to lose weight or whatever you're wanting to do, I would say things have got to be done moderately. So if you're not very big to start with, you shouldn't be having something in the same scale or proportion as somebody who is bigger than you, or taller than you, or whatever it is. So that's point one. And I think, people's understandings of diversity and what's out there, I think people become very sort of like apples and pears, and that's what fruit is. And it's, you know, think about choice out there. And, you know, I mean, I don't live in London, but my brother's lived in London, and go to visit him regularly. So there kind of is variety there within some shops. It's just I think people are very sort of tunnel vision, a bit more reluctant to try different things or eat enough of things. Again, it's going to be like quantity and moderation. I think people don't eat enough of certain things, and then they're too waylaid to sort of like be enhanced by fast food or something that's a bit quicker to whip up. But I mean, I didn't think it's not too difficult to eat an apple, I don't think. So that's one approach. But and for me, I think that seeing the reduction in the amount of markets and the quality of markets. I mean, if I'm comparing what I'm seeing as like street food comparative to going to the continent, I've recently been to the south of France and northern Italy on a garden bursary trip funded by the RHS. So shout out to them. There's so much more fruit and vegetables available pretty much as you're walking down the road. Whereas you could say you actually have to make the effort to go into a supermarket, superstore, whatever to actually, and yet, you know, you have to go looking with intent and with some purpose. Whereas I feel out there, it's pretty much just hits you in the face. So you kind of almost like, oh, right. Oh yeah, there it is. I'll just take that, rather than having to think, oh, I need to go and try something new today.
I wanted to shift gears on you just a little bit. I know you've been around gardens all year. What frustrated you in gardens this year, and did anything pleasantly surprise you?
Oh, I think having not had a proper hard frost last winter, and it continued to be that little bit mild, I was surprised at how much sort of like top fruit was produced, how well things in Roseacea did, like, you know, how many apples and pears we actually you know, obtained, and the glut of fruit that kind of came from that. And also other things, which things like the common oak tree, where you're thinking, oh, we're going to need, it's going to, you know, the fruits that have been set are going to need a period of a frost before they can kickstart themselves into germination, and or to induce germination, should I say? And they didn't receive that yet. They all just germinated, were just germinating so well. So, you know, local woodland and stuff is just filled with oak seedlings, and you're thinking, well, if the book says this is supposed to happen and it didn't, then should it or should it not? So, I mean, for me, that was one of the surprises. And then things that have gone really well but unexpected. I just think the extension of the seasons this year. I think sometimes you notice, you think, oh, that's gone over quite quickly, or you know, my meadow hasn't really flourished this year. You know, that everything kind of came up at once. I don't think we really had that. I think we had a really, the season took a little while to get going, but it's been a really long, prolonged spell. I'd say from mid to late March, I'd say all the way through until only a couple of weeks ago, that I've, you know, been surrounded by colour, really, various forms in different places. So I just think it's been very successful, but I wouldn't be able to put my finger on why that's happened.
That's fascinating what you said about the apples. I live in orchard country, and we had a disastrous season. The price of apples was up like, I don't know, 20% for cost to go pick your own. And it was because we had such an intense, brutal winter. I don't know if you heard the phrase polar vortex. The college kids created a drinking game that if you heard a person on TV say polar vortex, you had to take a shot of your favorite drink. And it was, and it impacted our summer. So like the whole middle of North America was either frozen or underwater half of 2014. So you guys had no killing frost, so you had a bumper crop.
Yeah, we just had such a lot of rain in the winter. I'm just because we didn't get the colder conditions. We had them, but we had a like a tidal surge, and then lots of places ended up flooding all over the country, and lot, you know, like X amount of months rain in so many hours, and some really, really bad scenes. And it's almost like about a year on from some of these places being hit that hard. And you're just thinking, well, although it's not going to be instant, some things it would be like instant death and drowning of certain plants, but some things you're thinking, I wonder what the impact of this weather is going to be for, you know, whether there's like a 5-year lag time on something, and it's because of some unforeseen weather patterns or something. You know, it's difficult to predict.
Let's take a minute to thank our sponsors and then come back and play 5 quick questions. Attention, garden lovers. Do you want to save time, save money, and have your most amazing garden ever? Receive free tips, strategies, and gardening techniques from passionate gardeners around the world. Join the VIP club for free today, like right now, at www.backtomygarden.com/VIP. What's the hottest trend in gardening? I think the hottest trend is aquaponics. Can you really grow a huge, incredible, colossal garden powered by fish like tilapia? Find out more and get a cheat sheet. Discover the secrets to building fish-powered gardens at www.backtomygarden.com/fish. As much as I'd love to keep talking about climate change, I just looked at the clock and our time is whipping by. Ben, now is the time in the show where we play a game called Five Quick Questions. Yeah, this is your chance to share your wisdom and experience with rookie amateur gardeners. Are you ready to play?
Yes.
Question number one. What's the biggest gardening mistake that you've ever made that you'll admit to?
Oh. I'll admit to it, don't worry. I think possibly some of the first plants that I ever bought, I didn't actually water them afterwards, and then I wondered why they were not doing so well. It's like just the excitement probably of planting it and then thinking, yeah, I've done that, and then lack of aftercare. So, yeah, water your plants, you know, important.
I watered them last year. They should be good, yeah. Good, good. Question number two. What's a skill that you possess in the garden that is extremely efficient or something you're proud of?
Ooh. I think it's the ability sometimes to see what a plant is going to look like after and during restoration. So I think if you've got something that's overgrown, lots of domestic gardens have got this, and it's I think I've got the eye for seeing through like knowing what I want the framework of that plant to then look like after I've done the task, and then knowing what it's going to look like within 2 years because of the work that I've done to it.
That's a brilliant answer. I have a friend who's a musician, and I cannot understand how he can write music the way he does. And my wife likes to paint and draw. Designing gardens, it's almost like you have a part of your brain that I lack, like spatial harmonics almost.
I like that phrase. That's good. Yeah, spatial harmonic. That's, yeah. I mean, because I wouldn't necessarily think of myself as a raw designer. I've just got, sometimes I've got an inkling of what I'd like or what I think would fit in an area, but it's something that I'm still working on, so... Yeah, but I like that, spatial harmonics.
I look at a plant and I see something green. My wife looks at it and she sees color and texture and scent and vertical and where it will be in 2 years. And yeah, I just don't have that skill set. I'm more of a linear thinker, I guess. But I always admire the people that have that gift. Question three. The internet's a really useful tool for gardeners. Can you share a couple of websites, one or two websites that maybe you like to read or use as a resource or a blog?
Yes. I'm really pleased that you mentioned the word blog there. I'll start off with a blog by a lady called Holly Allen. And she hers is a garden bird blog, so just Google that. And she gives a really great informal and warm sort of insight into her work that she's doing and the volunteering that she's doing in a much like less factual and more personal conveying of that. So I think that I've read some of her blog and I think it's brilliant. So I think that's well worth having a look, whatever your ability, because sometimes you don't want all the facts listing, you know, just listed, because sometimes that scares people. So I think sometimes an approach to find out how other people are doing things is top notch. So go and check that out. And also, Sean Cameron with the Horticultural Channel, well worth looking. It's predominantly vegetable and allotment based, but he's got loads of videos up there. It's great guy. He's put in loads of work for this to try and use new digital media to help. All sorts of amateur gardeners with and a couple of pros as well to start doing things and how do I develop my allotment, my plot, the back of my garden, my veg patch, whatever. So well worth checking those two out.
I try to explain allotment gardening to my friends, how big it is in England, but I live 10 minutes from a town of 20,000 people. And my little town the town next to me of 20,000 people has three community gardens with over a 200-person waiting list. So allotment gardening is starting to catch on even here in rural Canada.
Excellent. Yeah, that's what that's what you want to hear. I think the whole grow your own sort of campaign or type thing, it should be an international thing. It shouldn't just be, you know, one or two countries or, you know, a certain continent. I think it's like anywhere where we can do it, we should. So excellent news.
Question number four, Ben, is can you recommend a good book that all beginner gardeners should read? Or maybe a personal favorite gardening book of yours?
Okay. So I'm going to go for, it's called The Names of Plants by David Gledhill. And it's produced by the Cambridge University Press in the UK. And it's just fascinating because you can turn seeing plant labels on botanic gardens into a whole new world, because the names of plants or the naming of plants are just really interesting. You might think, oh, I don't know what that means. And this book has pretty much just got all the words in there for you. So all you have to do is just use it as a dictionary and don't have to always be able to remember what they are. But it's just like, if you've got the plant there and you've got the label and then you look up the words, Latin kind of then becomes... turns into English, really, so it's a bit easier to understand. And if you've got that plant doing its thing at the time, you know, whether it's a foliage plant or it's in flower or it's got berries or fruit or whatever, then you might say, oh right, and now I understand why it's called what it's called, because you then understand its name. So it's kind of like learning a language in your garden.
Fantastic. Now, question number five is a fun one. There's no right or wrong answer. Just look into your crystal ball into the future. Is there any kind of a plant that you've never grown that you're really looking forward or wanting to experiment with maybe in the next year or two?
There's plenty of plants which I haven't looked at growing, which I'd probably be interested in growing. I'm trying to learn new plants all the time. It's likely to be something that's a bit more exotic, so it probably needs a bit more indoor care in our country and in yours. Maybe something like a Bomeria. It's kind of like a climb. I don't know if it would be a climber or a small shrub with trumpet-ish like flowers. It's quite difficult to explain. Bomeria, anyway, I think is one option. Or, I mean, loads of the epiphytes. Some of the tillandsias can be really cool, or there's so many different species of orchid which would be really interesting to have a go at as well, thinking that they're not really going to need a lot of medium to grow into. So, I mean, that's a whole new area. I've never grown epiphytes before, so maybe have a go at that.
Let me give you a bonus 5B here, is you're off to Sicily for 6 months. What's something that the Italians don't grow that the British do that you might unleash upon them or share with them?
Oh, I like that. That gives me a sense of like I've got some power or something.
You're going to eat this.
I think having... I didn't see them use... fragrance on shrubs as much. I see a lot of succulents and then from the herbaceous things that they grow or the annuals that they grow, you know, you've got lots of herbs and things like that which where you've got a lot of aromatic odors, but I think they're sort of like possibly don't grow as many fragrant shrubs. So maybe we throw in something like a chimonanthus or maybe a lanicera of some sort that might work in a walled garden, which they're not like too overly exposed, and they might give some perfume to a courtyard or something like that, maybe.
Nice. Chimonanthus.
Yeah, praecox is the species. So,
if you're driving, don't try to put that into your phone with your thumb. I'll have a link up. I'll have a link up on the site.
Yeah, I mean, it's more sort of like a winter fragrant shrub for that we use it here in this country. So, but I think you've got a variety of Lanisteras as well, which, you know, they can be shrubby or they can be climbers, and then they could fit into that, and then I think they can tolerate a level of dryness. You know, you might need to care for them a bit more in terms of when it gets really dry, keep watering it. But yeah, I think fragrance is sometimes really undermined. You know, people just they think, oh, well, if I haven't been to a garden, then I'll just look at the photographs. And I think sometimes that's where you get something that an aspect which is missed, because you miss out on the smells.
Nice. For those of you playing the home game, listening along, make sure you follow Ben on Twitter at the Hort Doctor, and check him out and like him on Facebook at facebook.com/thehortdoctor. Ben, you're brilliant. You've been an excellent guest. Have a great time in Sicily. We'll have to have you back after you get back so you can share your adventures with everybody.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's been great. So I'd happily come back.
Ben, I want to give you the last word to the listeners today. Can you leave us with either a pearl of wisdom or a note of encouragement on our gardening adventures?
Yeah. So I'm going to leave you with a little top tip. And I would always say, before starting a task, always use the appropriate tool for the job and the appropriate size tool for the individual, because it's, you know, you can then prioritize your movements, you can get into good positions, and you can reduce the back pain and keep on gardening for longer.
That's tremendous. And I'm going to actually take that one to heart. I have a shovel that's about 7 feet long. That's way too big for me. Oh, that's good, Ben. Tremendous stuff. I'll put the links up on the show notes. Make sure you check it out at backtomygardener.com. It'll be episode 78. Ben, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you.